Good morning. I'm Charlie Meyerson. Welcome to Point of View on WNUA 95.5 Chicago. This time out, a respected journalist takes a close look at the power and the passion, the poverty and the pain of the urban street corner.
They're not just out here to sling and shoot drugs. Lives without any obvious justification are given definition through a simple, self-sustaining capitalism. In this place only they belong. In this place only they know what they are, why they are, and what it is they are supposed to do. On Fayette Street today, the corner world is what's left to serve up truth and power, money and meaning. It gives life and takes life. Amid nothing, the corner is everything.
It's David Simon, who, with Edward Burns, has written The Corner, A Year in the Life of an Inner-City Neighborhood, the real story of an inner-city intersection in Baltimore, West Fayette and Monroe Streets. You may know Mr. Simon better as the author of a book called Homicide, which inspired the television series of the same name. Mr. Simon's also a producer and writer for that show and for NYPD Blue, and he may be one of the nation's foremost practitioners of what he calls stand-around-and-watch journalism. Thanks for coming. Welcome to Point of View.
Thanks for having me.
Okay, I'm going to begin the show with what probably is going to be the dumbest question of this half hour, and that is, what is stand-around-and-watch journalism?
It is sort of self-explanatory, I hope. I have a theory that if you stay in one place long enough, good things will happen. I was a newspaper reporter for most of my career, and of great frustration was the fact that you would go somewhere and you would start to get the interior lives of the people living in an event, and then you would have to pull up and write your story and go somewhere else. I found when I wrote Homicide, researched it and wrote it from 88 to 91, that by staying with the characters for more than a year and following them, greater or deeper levels of truth were revealed. And I felt that that was the kind of journalism that I wanted to pursue, the idea that if you stay with people long enough, you'll be able to acquire an interior voice that you wouldn't otherwise.
Now, how did that work in this case?
Not easily. The neighborhood that we went into is a drug-involved area of West Baltimore. It's predominantly black, in fact, virtually all black. And myself and my co-author were somewhat pale in that regard.
both Caucasian.
Right? Yes. And at first, and my co-author was a former 20-year veteran of the Baltimore Police Department, a former narcotics and homicide detective. So right away we were made for police, and we had to do a lot of convincing people that we were actually there to write a book and that we were not doing any law enforcement at all. And that took about 4 weeks.
Yeah, I mean, I think to most of us, that's kind of a scary prospect. How did you go about persuading people that, you know, that you were going to be hanging around there for months and that you didn't pose a threat to them? And did you ever feel at that early stage in this process as if, you know, your safety were in jeopardy?
I think I felt more foolish than anything else. I mean, you're sort of standing out there looking very out of place, and I think we handled that with as much good humor as we could. I don't want to overstate the idea of danger in this project, because we went down there without, you know, with $2 in our pockets and a driver's license, wearing jeans and T-shirts, and we made very clear that we weren't down there to cop drugs or to do law enforcement, and there wasn't much incentive to mess with us. The real trick was getting people to open up their lives, and for that, I think, you know, we went for those small moments that connect human beings. You know, on a hot day, we'd buy the touts, the guys selling drugs, the guys bringing in the drug trade. We'd go and buy them iced tea at the corner store because it was a hot day, or we'd go play basketball with the younger kids, and we did the sort of things that cops don't do. There was one drug dealer who had an abscessed tooth, and it was that classic Aesop tale of, you know, pull the thorn out of the lion's
Androcles. Paw. Androcles'
yeah.
line.
Yeah. Yeah, and we did that. We went and took him to the University Hospital dental clinic and got that tooth pulled for him. And after that, he walked up to that corner and said, well, I don't know what they are, but they're not cops, you know. No cop would ever do that for me.
Is this a book that, I mean, did you have the title before you had the book? I mean, did you decide it was going to be a corner, or did the corner become the focus of your work only after you hung around the neighborhood
Once,
for a while?
I think after we hung around, we realized that the corner itself is almost a character in the book. It's what stands in opposition to the community in general. It's the centerpiece of the drug trade in that neighborhood and in any other of maybe 120 open-air drug markets in my city. It's the gathering place, and we started to realize that along with the flesh and blood characters that we were following, this thing had a power all its own, and that we really were writing about its essence and what it does to people.
Point of View on WNUA 95.5, Charlie Meyerson here. Our guest is Baltimore journalist David Simon, co-author of The Corner, A Year in the Life of an Inner City Neighborhood. Tell everyone about your partner, Edward Burns. He's a former cop.
Yeah.
And he was known
by cops and
non-cops alike.
There was that ugly moment, I think, in the first week we were down there when a guy named Terry Hamlin, Eggie Daddy by street name, walked up and sat next to Ed on the stoop in front of one of the shooting galleries and said, "You know, you remember me?" And Ed didn't, of course. You know, it's been a long police career. And Eggy said, "Well, you locked me up." And Ed said, "Well, was it a right arrest?" And Eggy said, "Yeah, I was dirty." And Ed said, "Okay." And they sort of looked at each other for a moment, and then Eggy walked away. Right away it got around that this guy used to be a cop and was saying he was, and he was retired at that point.
He's
a school teacher now. But you had to wear people down. I mean, and you had to get past who we were and what we'd done. We passed out an awful lot of copies of Homicide. That got us over. Although, you know, look, we're really writers. This guy wrote a book before. I don't want to suggest that we had to, it was all us eroding them or their will, because even people who were involved in the drug game, it's gotten so out of hand now, at least in my city and I think in many others, that even people who are living the event, who are using drugs and selling drugs, they sort of realize that the corner has become too much, that there's too much going on there, that it is destroying neighborhoods, destroying communities. And there was a sense that if you're here to bear witness, I got a story for you. And so in some ways we found them, but they also found us.
How did you choose this particular corner?
Almost at random. It was a corner that was hot the year before, had a lot of shootings, a lot of violence. I knew the area a little bit because I'd done some stories for the newspaper earlier in that area. And also it was near a white, a working class white area. So the drug trade was decidedly multicultural. All the sellers, all the crews might have been black, but a lot of the buyers were coming north across Baltimore Street to cop. And I thought that was important. I did not want to suggest that to anybody that the drug trade was anything but multicultural.
You witnessed a lot of crimes in this book, at least what many people would consider crimes or the law considers crimes. Mm-hmm. Even, some might say, assisted in the commission of some of those crimes.
Well, we didn't. They would have happened whether we were there or not.
Well, but I mean, you played a role. You wound up playing a role in it. And talk about that. I mean, you do in the afterword of your book.
Oh, I don't have any problem with the idea that we were there when crimes were committed.
No.
Or that we didn't, you know, drop a dime on somebody.
Well, but I mean, you helped some of these guys get drugs. You gave them money to get their fixes.
We gave them money. We didn't help them get the drugs. I mean, we did not give them money to enhance the information coming back from us.
No.
That those were always circumstances in which you would have a guy, you'd take a guy like Gary McCullough out of his game for 3 hours.
And you say out of it, we need to explain, first of all,
okay,
who's Gary McCullough
and
what's his game?
You're right. Well, Gary McCullough was a wonderful guy. Sort of try to imagine St. Francis of Assisi with a heroin habit, and you've got Gary McCullough. Just a wonderful guy in very many respects, but nonetheless completely absorbed in his addiction. And we were following him, and he was a guy who, when he woke up in the morning, his first job was to get $10. And if you happen to pick up his life, and you dragged him down to a park bench for 3 hours and had 3 hours of interviews with him and talked to him about what he'd done the night before, and you were taking him out of his game. That was time that he needed to get his blast money, either by tearing copper piping out of a vacant house or by running some errand for one of the corner stores or doing some work down at the Crab House. He had a bunch of small time gigs or capers or.
Yeah, I have to jump in here for naive people like myself. You know, before I read your book, blast money, drug money.
I'm sorry.
Yeah,
yes.
No, that's okay.
I'm talking in the vernacular.
Well, I think that's one of the things that makes the book so compelling.
Right.
He needed. I'm here as interpreter.
Right. He needed $10 to get high, And here you are, you're a writer, and you've dragged him down to a park bench at Union Square for 3 hours and taken up his time, and now he's getting physically sick. Yeah, at that point I gave him $10. But as a practice, we did not intervene in events or try to give money to enhance the journalism.
But this whole stand around and watch journalism thing, in this book in particular, raised some conflicts between the way journalists have traditionally approached their role of non-involvement. I mean, it's tough to stand around for a year and not get involved in some ways like this.
Well,
and
what
sort of conflicts did that set up within your conscience, journalistic or moral or otherwise?
Well, journalistic, I didn't have a problem. I don't think it's my role to be law enforcement or to in some way intervene because somebody's breaking the law. I don't have a badge. I have a notepad. But as far as the morality of standing around and watching somebody destroy themselves by degrees or make the wrong decisions or sort of walk headlong into what you know is going to end up as a tragedy, that's very hard.
Yeah, that's the other aspect.
And, to get back to Gary McCullough, this was a wonderful man, a very giving man, a man who had been broken by addiction, but nonetheless had all of his humanity intact. And I came to regard him as a friend, and there was nothing... I felt like I couldn't intervene while the journalism was going on, but even after the year was over and the friendship was maintained. And, there were times where I tried to intervene. I tried to get him to go to treatment and detox. He did go once. And when he ultimately died of a heroin overdose in 96, last year, it tore me up. When I decided I was going to do this book, I wasn't thinking about that moment.
Yeah. Did you find yourself second-guessing yourself, give up the book, I'm going to do something, I'm going to devote my time to helping this guy, these people, the journalism is keeping me from getting more involved than I would otherwise?
Yeah, there were times. I generally chose the side of the journalism for most of the 93 when we were in that neighborhood full-time. Beginning in about 95, I decided the journalism's over, the book's over. I don't want to go to any more funerals. But there's a peculiar form of vanity that says, oh, here I am, I've landed here with a notepad and now, I'm some fancy pants writer and so I'll tell them what the right way to do life is and they'll listen to me. I mean, the corner is a powerful force. I mean, the forces operating against these people, societal and otherwise, are just incredible. So the idea that I'm going to show up, with some good intentions or a kind word here or there or a favor or a ride to the detox center and change the course of events is a peculiar form of vanity.
Point of View on WNUA 95.5. I'm Charlie Meyerson. Our guest is journalist David Simon, who's the co-author of the book The Corner, A Year in the Life of an Inner City Neighborhood. Now, how about your co-author, your partner, Ed Burns, a former cop? Was it any harder for him to stand around and watch while crimes that he once upon a time in another career would have been trying to fight?
Incredibly, I think it was easier for him in this sense. Ed was a guy who did major cases. He did, when there was a drug crew that was killing a lot of people, he would target the crew. I mean, most of his casework was joint federal-local. So here he is at the street level watching the drug trade where it's effectively legal. And by that, what I mean to say is it's not legal, it's still against the law, and some people every now and then are going to get locked up for it. But by the numbers, it's become legal in West Baltimore. I think this is also true of some areas of South Chicago or East New York or North Philly. There are 50,000 to 60,000 drug users in my city, which is about 1 in 12 for the population. In the entire state of Maryland, for all crimes, all jurisdictions, all 24 counties, there's 22,000 prison cells total. There's no way to arrest your way out of this problem. The drug war has effectively become meaningless in a place like West Baltimore. And I think Ed sensed that to a greater degree than I did. So the idea of getting worked up because somebody just passed a vial in front of him meant nothing. I mean, he would have, when he was a cop, he would have used that only to make a bigger case. So what we were seeing on that level, I don't think was a problem for him.
I like the way you've structured this book. Unlike a lot of similar books, there is no long introduction. It just gets right into the action. Chapter 1, page 1. The afterword, though, is fascinating, I think, as a textbook for students or anyone of journalism and how you went about doing this. And I'm always curious with authors we have in here about how works like this manage to get into the heads of their subjects, how authors can be confident describing the feelings, the sensations, the attitudes of the people that they write about. And that's an essential part of this book. How'd you do it?
Well, we were there for a lot of it. I would say about 70 to 75% of the scenes in the book we witnessed. And then when you're writing from an interior point of view of the character, what effectively happened there was that, you know, after an event happened, Gary McCullough or his son DeAndre or Fran Boyd or Fat Kurt or one of the other characters in the book would be there with us, and they would have a conversation with us. Well, in order to write third-person narrative, you're not going to jump, unless you really want to destroy your own narrative, you're not going to say, and here's the part where Kurt turned to the writer and said, the reason I just cussed him out was X, Y, and Z. Instead, you put that as an interior thought to Kurt, because it is his thought. He expressed it at the same time. Do you want to include the quote? Once you put it in quotes and say, Kurt said, as if you said it to the reporter or to the writer, you've entered the world of sort of standard journalism, and you've effectively destroyed storytelling as an art. And that's what, you know, most of the good narrative journalists have come to realize. Did Kurt think the exact thoughts and the exact words that I have in his head? Roughly, but exactly, no. And if you want to call that the great lie of narrative journalism, I guess it is. Kurt did think that idea, and I put it into words that Kurt expressed to me. But did he think it in his head in the exact way he expressed it to me, or was it muted or changed because he was expressing it to me? How many angels can dance on the head of a pin?
Yeah, and you took some pains after this year was up, and even while it was going on, to double-check the authenticity of some of the things you were told, because you were dealing with people who, by the nature of their lives and actions, were engaged in lying on a frequent basis.
Yeah, we were lied to.
Tell us about that.
We were lied to about everything. The classic example is that the main character, 15-year-old DeAndre McCullough, had started snorting heroin at the end of that year. We knew he was getting high with weed and with drinking, and we suspected use of heroin or smoking crack because he was starting to become erratic by Christmas. Yet, and so did his mother suspect that. Yet we had no proof, and he continuously denied it, not only for the rest of that year, but for 94 as well. In 95, finally, when he finally bottomed out, he told the truth. And that's one thing about this type of journalism. If you go in for a week or a month or 6 months, sometimes you end up buying the lie because, you know, people are able to play false with their lives over a period of time. But, you know, you keep at it. You keep in the game, and you keep watching the same people for a long enough period of time. And, you know, we all can't sustain a lie that long. I know I can't, you know. I mean, you know, you can be telling yourself a lie, but eventually, you know, life deals you the straight hand. And by following these characters from the beginning of 93 all the way through to 96, I think we got more truth than fiction.
Point of View on WNUA 95.5. Our guest is David Simon, co-author of The Corner, A Year in the Life of an Inner City Neighborhood. What lessons do you think people in Baltimore and in other parts of the country concerned about or living near corners of their own can gather from your work?
Well, I think there's two things that I want to have come across in the book, and I'm not sanguine about either, but I'm trying anyway. One is, these are human beings. There's been a lot of demonology that has accompanied the drug war, so that our image now of people using and selling drugs amounts to nothing more than, like on that cop show where they kick in the door and the guy runs in a rage jacket, and he chases the guy around and throws him against the wall and grabs the 30 vials and you know, claims victory. These are human beings, flawed, struggling, making bad choices, doing bad things at times, but doing more harm to themselves than anybody else. 95% of the people we met on that drug corner could not hurt another person. They were not in the slightest bit sociopathic. 5% would hurt you in a bad way, and it's knowing, you know, therein lies the rub. But 95% of them, they might make a car radio disappear in a heartbeat if you left your car door unlocked. But that's the first thing. The second thing is that the drug war has now become dysfunctional in places like West Baltimore. It may still be a deterrent in some places in the country. I'm sure it is in some places in the country that don't have this rate of IV drug use and rate of poverty. But right now, it needs to be ratcheted down because it's actually destroying police work in my city. While the police department has indulged all its furies chasing people like Fat Kurt and Gary McCullough and DeAndre McCullough around the streets of Baltimore to no possible end because there's no place to put them. I mean, Maryland is 10th in the nation per capita in terms of locking people up. We're not slouches at that, but even so, we have no prison space for street-level drug arrests. While they've expended all the resources on that, the clearance rate for all other crimes, for all major felonies, has declined dramatically in that period. It's like the city's become deeply involved in a drug war, yet it's become more violent and less livable. And I think the two are connected.
So specifically, I mean, what would you recommend, or what are you recommending for legislators, community leaders in Chicago, around the country, Baltimore, Maryland?
Well, I'm not recommending any kind of legalization argument. That's a bruising political fight that has no possible purpose and can't be won. But I am saying ratchet it down. Ratchet it down. If you're making 19,000 drug arrests in Baltimore a year, which they are, which is, I think, second highest in the country per capita, make 12,000. You know, make the ones you need to make to keep the corners that are, you know, commercial strips or around elementary schools or near rec centers. You know, prioritize and use the existing resources that you would save. If you processed 7,000 less drug arrests, just for the sheer amount of money you're spending on cops, on pretrial detention, on pretrial investigations, on judges, on prosecutors and public defenders, if you put that money into treatment beds, I mean, in the same five-year period, Baltimore didn't create a new treatment bed. I mean, they're starting to get to that now. But if you threw some of the money into education, if you in some ways threw the money into job training and tried to reacquaint this lost quadrant of America, these inner city areas, with the economy, with the general scheme of the economy and society, they are so isolated in places like Fayette Street that the corner proves itself where nothing else does. I mean, we want to think it's just about money and about chemical addiction. It's about so much more. It is about having a reason to believe. I mean, DeAndre McCullough, when he goes down to a corner to sell drugs, he's good at it. It's the one thing he's good at. It's the one thing where he has absolute credibility. The rest of the country hums along nicely without him, and he's smart enough to sense that. So I think the one thing that has to happen is you have to ratchet down the drug war. We've reached the end game. It can't work.
What about community policing? Of course, that's the buzzword in across the country.
Yeah.
Is it going to have any impact on this?
How do you police a community where 40 or 50 or 60% of the people are involved in violating a national prohibition? I mean, the drug war has utterly alienated these communities from the police so that when a shooting happens or the church gets burglarized or the rec center gets burglarized or there's a string of armed robberies, no information's coming back to these officers. Absolutely none, because the officers have consistently alienated the population by trying to enforce a prohibition that nobody believes in. You know, and because of that alienation, because it runs two ways, we saw incredible brutality. We saw some police doing very good police work and very honest police work, and we saw some very poor police work and some very brutal police work aimed at people because of the alienation of the police. You know, and I'm somebody very, very well disposed to good police work. I mean, my first book was about good police work. But you have to reacquaint the country with what is possible and what is not, and that's a painful thing because the country basically has an impulse to say, I'm tired of this. I'm tired of reading about it. I'm tired of being afraid of it. Lock these people up. But there's no room.
What continuing contact do you have with the neighborhood? Do you go back on a regular basis?
I do. Actually, there's going to be a strange event in a couple weeks. We're going to have a party for the people who were in the book. And the people who were characters in the book, who were selling drugs, and some of them are still on the corner, God help them, and others are... There's a couple people in this. There are some victories in this book. Blue, the guy running the shooting gallery the year we were there, walked away and is now 3 years clean and doing drug rehab work with other addicts. Fran Boyd, DeAndre's mother, who was addicted for 20 years, walked away and is now working and living out in the county. So people who were on the corner, people who are still on the corner, are going to come back and have one dance or two with also the police in the neighborhood, and it should be a very bizarre party.
Our guest on Point of View on WNUA 95.5 has been David Simon, co-author of The Corner, A Year in the Life of an Inner-City Neighborhood, 2750 from Broadway Books. I'm Charlie Meyerson. Thank you for joining us, and thanks to our WNUA production ace, Bill Cochran, for his hard work on our snazzy new Point of View theme song, which goes like this.
The views expressed on Point of View are those of the participants and not necessarily those of WNUA 95.5 or Chancellor Media Corporation. You can write to us at 444 North Michigan, Chicago 60611, or send your email to wnuanews@aol.com. Point of View is an exclusive presentation of the news department of WNUA 95.5, Chicago.